Hello and welcome to The Good Robot Andy's Season 11, Episode 5. My name's Andy Balaam and this is...
Andy Cockerill.
And we are extremely privileged today to be joined by Harry and Ben. Welcome, Harry and Ben.
Hello.
Hi.
And we are in the same room,
which is...
unusual. Excellent.
And excellent.
And some of us are still buzzing because we've just been to see...
Dune Part 2 at...
the IMAX.
The biggest screen in...
UK and Northern Ireland.
Thank you.
Exactly. So, Ben, how did you feel walking out of Dune 2?
It was so good. Best movie in a long time, I would say.
Wow.
I feel like it really kind of summed up... I mean, obviously, it was clear that there was another movie coming, but it really summed up stuff that was left hanging from the first movie.
Right. It was satisfying enough for you then.
Mm.
So I was sat there with a massive smile on my face for a lot of it. How about you, Harry?
I'm, like, giddy by the end of it. I came out, like, wobbling. It was incredible, everything about it. I think compared to 1, it's like a step up.
Oh, right, okay. Interesting. In what way? More intense or better? Or
I think, more intense, but I think better. I think, like, obviously part 1 was what Denis Villeneuve has been, like, building up to.
Right.
And then part 2 is, like...
It's
just more. Yeah. I don't even know how to explain it. It's just more.
I think just kind of... he's got into his stride and he's into the kind of meaty parts of it. Because a lot of 1 is kind of setting up and stuff. And now you get the real proper stuff. And
The proper story. What do you think, Andy?
I loved it. I was like Harry. My legs were shaking at the end of it.
I was sweating.
Not just because I was sat down for a long time, but just it was such an intense experience seeing it on that big screen. The sound.
Yeah, the sound
was just phenomenal.
In both of them.
My seat was shaking.
Yeah.
It's still very clear.
Yeah.
And I mean, dialogue was very clear.
The thing for me was I didn't watch the first one in IMAX, so even though it was 3 years ago, I can remember what it was like and. IMAX makes such a difference to the sound, but I think sound is the most important thing with IMAX, because especially in that film, every time there's something important happening, you can feel it. Because of the...
particularly when someone uses the voice.
Oh, it's so scary.
It's like, oh!
Especially when Jessica uses it. It's interesting comparing that to the book, because in the book, she... is written as a kind of a less sinister character. She felt very sinister.
I was going to say
manipulative.
She's so sinister.
But the voice, like in the cinema, like goes through you.
Yes.
It's really quite unnerving and quite scary.
So you feel when she uses it at the end against the Reverend Mother.
Yes.
You feel why the Reverend Mother is so affected by it.
My wife said that the. Compared with, say, like Star Wars or something where people use like their voice to manipulate people and it's not very sinister. Actually, that's incredibly sinister and Dune makes it sinister.
I mean, the thing with Star Wars, which is slightly confusing, is that it's the good guys using it normally, which is a bit weird because if you think about it, it's kind of horrific. And she's, Jessica particularly, she's on the good guy side. I don't know whether you call her a good guy, though, because there aren't really any good guys.
That's what makes it interesting. Because at one point in the middle, I was just thinking, what am I going to say after this? I'm going to say, you know what? I'm getting a feeling that maybe the Harkonnens are not nice people. It became so much more... it's sophisticated and interesting.
Yeah, very much so.
All the good guys.
What do you think, your positives, you know, off the top of your head?
I mean, to me, the sound in both these two films is the star of the show. Yeah.
The sound design and the music are just incredible.
Absolutely. Including the music, which is really intrusive, but I'm fine with that.
Because it's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sound and... The worms. Like, you have to get the worms right if you're going to do Dune.
And did they get them right?
Oh,
yeah.
So good.
The moment when he's riding, he stands up on the worm, and you see, and it goes past, and it just keeps going and going and going.
I felt like I was on a roller coaster. I was just thinking to myself, this is okay, but I'm not sure it's as much good, not as good as the first one. Then the worm thing came up, and he did. And I was like, okay, this is just.
It's so strange how the battles, the actual battle, is a very short section in the end, but there's no lack of action throughout the whole thing. Yeah, there's this constant feeling of movement, and there's something happening or about to happen.
Yeah. So, Harry, did you care about the love story?
No. I think it was like, it was built up to be something. And then even, just, I don't know, it was very unconvincing.
Right.
I didn't feel like there was actually something there. And I
didn't. They didn't give it a lot of time, did they?
No.
Yeah, I think it was, they were trying to stay faithful to the book, because in the book, it's pretty much, there's almost no tension, especially in the first book. So they were trying to stay faithful in the fact that she does love him, but they wanted to make her a more interesting character by having conflict between them. But then you need time to prove that they actually love each other before you have the conflict, which was
so. Kind is that of the thing? Because you said they changed it from the book. Is that the thing they changed, that she objects to his
calling? Well, so the biggest change that I noticed was just much more nuance within the Fremen and for her particularly, right. Is in the books, the Fremen almost immediately all get behind Paul, and they're immediately kind of loyal to him and just believe that he is the Messiah. But in this story, there's a lot more conflict with that, and specifically with Chaney, there's a lot more interesting things. She's more of a 3D character. There's more kind of more story with it, because you have this conflict, and at the end, part of the reason you can tell that they want another movie is because this unresolved conflict with her, where she goes off into the desert,
which I thought was brilliant.
Mm.
Yeah, some really nice
that full frame shot. Bit of a spoiler. Full frame shot of her at the end.
They're going to be spoilers.
Staring past the camera was just stunning. Yeah. I thought, okay, that's the final shot.
Yeah.
And you knew that it was the final shot. Yeah. I think it was really good, because sometimes with movies, especially with a movie like Dune, by the end you'd think, is this the end? And then it keeps going. But you know that's the end. You look at it, screaming and whacking like, yeah.
That's what I would think of as the Lord of the Rings problem, where at the end of Return of the King, there's about 10 endings.
Yeah.
And you're like, has it finished? No, there's another 20 minutes of the film left. But
stuff that I liked, I loved Javier Bardem. I still got.
Yeah.
So in the book, I seem to remember him being quite po-faced without any kind of sense of humour.
Right.
In this, he's quite light relief a lot of the time.
There was quite a lot of laughter in the cinema.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was some laughter at a particular bit, which was, I think, a very deliberate reference to Life of Brian.
Yes, definitely.
In which people said, only the Messiah would deny his true. He must be the Messiah. Yes. People were laughing at that, which I thought was funny.
Yeah. And I think just all the way through, he was just constantly being like, the Messiah. Yeah. I think everyone found that quite funny.
Yeah. It was quite funny. I think at some points it was funny, but at some points it was very moving. Right near the end, when they're in this cave with thousands of Fremen, when he stands up at that moment,
amazing.
It's so powerful. Yeah, yeah. It's not funny anymore.
No, it was real. So I enjoyed that. Loved Austin Butler as Fayard Rotha.
Who's that?
He's
the son, the nephew.
The cousin. The nephew. He was brilliant.
He was good. Yeah,
really, really good. A complete transformation. So the last time I saw him in anything was Elvis, in which he played Elvis Presley.
Right, okay.
I walked into that expecting an Elvis accent. And it wasn't there, which was good, because I was really worried he was going to be doing an Elvis accent.
He was great. Not enough Dave Bautista.
Oh, we love Dave Bautista.
But maybe Dave Bautista doesn't... Maybe that character doesn't have much to do in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a lot for him, was there?
And then other characters, Christopher Walken is Christopher Walken.
he was great in the amount that he was in. Yeah. I think he, if they'd had more time, I would really have wanted him to be in it more.
Yeah.
Because the bits he was in were really good.
I was just nervous he was going to be too Christopher Walken.
He did rain. I thought he reined his performance.
Yeah. I saw him out on the train there. Yeah. Although he reined it back, he didn't really rein still it back him. Enough because it was still Christopher Walken.
He still got that voice.
Yeah.
And he did do the walk.
He did the walk.
But to be fair, I don't... I think you can't... You've chosen him for a reason, right? I think
why?
It's quite hard to...
It is a bit of a strange choice.
Yeah, I'm not condoning the choice. I'm just saying, if you've chosen that,
then you're
gonna have
to
deal with the consequences.
There's a particular scene that I thought was incredibly well handled, is when Paul drinks the water of life.
Uh-huh. Mm. Yeah.
And then she brings him back to life. That was incredible.
And the conflict between them is still very much central to that.
Yeah. So now she's complicit in the whole fake messiah thing that she's just not on board with. Now she's part of it.
And I mean, it's interesting because when Paul's talking about it, it seems like by the end, even her close friends, who at the start really didn't seem to believe her, believing she's the... It's so kind of lonely for her because she's the only one who doesn't believe now. And at the end, she, when in the cave, when she stands up and tries to say to people, "Look, he's trying to control you," no one listens.
No. Yeah, because they've swallowed the Kool-Aid.
That's fairly like it's the wives of great men who realise that they're not great at all, right? It's, it kind of makes sense there. It all basically makes sense, which is pretty good.
Yeah. Terrific battle scenes. There's a great assault on a spice miner.
Yes.
Where they use shadow and obstacles to evade an ornithopter, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah. Really well orchestrated. I found amazing, I've never been to the IMAX before, but the switch between like full screen, when they cut to full screen, they do it at really interesting moments. It's not just like really big open areas. They do it on like
people's close faces.
So during that scene, it happens like when they're behind the leg and using the shadow.
Feels like you're there.
But it sort of makes that scene even more intense because it's such a, you know, massive thing going on.
Yeah. And you definitely feel with all the action, you always know who you want to win and why. Mm-hmm. Right. And so many things, the action is about like what martial arts moves they do. And in this, it's about the people, you need the person to do the thing. I do think on the love story being like not really either not convincing or not really even focused on, in a way I think that fits because really it's a film about politics, right?
Yeah.
And so actually the main point of the love story is that it gets sacrificed for politics.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting how even at the point of the battle, she is very much not happy with him, but she's still willing to go and fight in the battle.
So I kind of feel, or I do feel, that part two is seen through Chani's eyes.
Right.
From her point of view of what's going on.
Because especially when Paul starts changing.
She's the lone voice of, he's not the saviour.
A lot of it, certainly the first film, felt like it was through Paul's eyes.
Yes.
And obviously we see his visions and stuff, so to some extent it's still through his eyes.
It is,
but after that time when he has the vision, when he's drunk the poison, then he starts changing, and then I definitely buy that it's then through her eyes.
Because I mean, as a neutral party, you know he's you know that he's not the Messiah, depending on what kind of counts as a Messiah, in that he does have the visions, but it's manufactured by the Bene Gesserit. So
and the spice.
So
she already told him that he's having those dreams because he's been ingesting spice.
Not because he's the
But the Bene Gesserit's religion is real in some sense, right? So in a sense, he is like something special because they've been breeding these bloodlines, right?
Yeah.
So he kind of is the Messiah.
I mean, when Frank Herbert was writing the book, he was a agnostic, and he, in all of his writing, he wrote religion as a tool. He was never, even if, his kind of perspective on it was, even if this person does have supernatural powers, they're still not the Messiah because they're using them to, like, even though he can see the future, he's using that in order to gain power, right? He's using his abilities and other people's belief in his abilities to gain power.
Yeah,
because obviously the point of the quiz at Tabarak is to guide everyone to a better future.
Yeah.
But Paul is using it to...
To become emperor.
To become emperor. Because he wants to... So that he can do what he believes is right instead of what is good for everybody.
But he's not just a human emperor. He's got... He can do the voice. He can see the future.
Yeah.
He's extremely powerful now.
Yeah. So that thing that he goes through is really interesting. Right? So I believe him at the point in the film where he says... I just want to be a Fremen and learn your ways. I believe him that that's what he wants.
At that point in the film.
And then he makes this transformation into essentially, especially, I guess the marriage is the particular demonstration that he's like, he's now doing politics kind of thing.
It's so interesting how after he takes the water of life, you can really feel, not just in the actions, but you can feel in the acting, he feels like a different person.
Yeah, yeah.
He has this kind of grim feeling of like, I'm just doing what I have to do, no matter the consequences. And it's hard to know, like, it doesn't seem like him anymore. Does he still have the same interests anymore? Does he even...
Yeah. He seems like he has a single-minded purpose then, which is to destroy the Harkonnen and take the Emperor's throne.
Yeah, and now to inherit the Harkonnen...
And possibly to wage war on the other noble families as well.
Which is a departure from in the book.
Okay.
In the book, the guild negotiate a peace where he becomes emperor.
Right.
And there isn't war. There is a holy war, but it's not with the other great houses. It's just kind of to spread the religion.
Right.
But in now there's this kind of direct conflict between him and the other great houses.
I suppose that's...
Yeah, we haven't really seen the guild in this...
No, yeah.
In these two films. We haven't seen the...
There was no guild navigators in this whole film.
No.
And I mean, there was only one shot of one in the first film.
That's right.
Mm. So, I don't know whether that's because they're trying to avoid some of the weirdness.
Maybe.
Or, because, I mean, especially the second book is a lot weirder than the first one. And the first one's pretty weird, so I don't know how they're gonna do that for the next film.
I mean, maybe they will introduce more navigators in the next movie.
I mean, they're definitely trying to avoid it, because I mean, David Lynch's one
that has navigators.
And I think they're similar to what they're meant to look like, and they're not human at all.
Very strange.
They're like a brain that's connected to the spaceship, which is really odd.
Yeah.
So what do we think about Jessica, his mum?
Oh, manipulative.
So Harry, you thought she was evil already at the end of film one.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't think that she really loves him.
Right. And I was like, no, she definitely loves him.
I don't think she does.
I think that she wanted to use, from the start, she wanted to use people's belief in him. But in the end of the first film, she's saying, we need to charter a ship to get off of this planet. And then after she takes the Water of Life, she changes her opinion to being like, we need to reestablish ourselves as a great house, to we need to use the Fremen to take over the universe, basically.
Mm.
And that shift is, I think, where I think she still loves Paul the whole time, and she's still kind of acting in what she thinks is his best interests, but what she thinks is his best interest changes. So now she's kind of just thinks that he needs to take power no matter what.
So she chose to conceive him. She could have had a girl, and she chose to have a boy, because apparently they can do that. And she did that because she, like, for basically personal ambition, really.
Yeah.
Then she had him, and she loves him, and she, like, has that scene with her not husband, the Jew.
The consort.
Yeah, because she's a consort.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saying, like, are you going to protect him? No, he says that to her.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
He asks her.
She clearly cares about him. She's very upset when he's having the pain thing done to his hand.
Mm.
Which
is addressed in this film, actually.
Right.
She talks about that.
Does she?
What does she say?
I can't remember, but somebody questions whether she's a good mother or not.
Oh, yeah, they say, like, you put him in that room.
That's right.
You let him, like, be hurt. And she's like, okay.
Also... We know that at the end of the first film, she's pregnant.
Yes.
In this one, she starts talking to her unborn child.
Yeah, she's crazy.
Quite a lot.
She's really crazy.
Yeah, it's because when she took in the Water of Life, the poison spread to the child.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kind of... The cure that she used her powers to give also affected the child. The child... And the Water of Life, what it does, if you survive it, is it puts the mind of previous reverent mothers into your head.
Mm-hmm.
So the unborn child now has these minds from thousands of people in her head, and that's why they call her an abomination at one point. The other reverent mother calls her an abomination because she's this kind of unborn child with adults in her head.
Yes. But, so presumably that child is going to be incredibly powerful.
We've only got Jessica's word for the fact that she's having this conversation. Now, as the viewer, we get to hear the conversation, so we know it's real in some sense.
But it might be just in her head.
It could all be just in her head.
Yeah. She could be losing her mind.
And I mean, it really depends how much they want to depart from in the book, because in the book it's definitely real, and she becomes a very important character who is arguably more powerful than Paul once she grows up to be an adult.
Right.
And she's a pretty scary character.
So maybe we'll see her in part three.
But so I think... Played by Anya Taylor-Joy, isn't she?
Hmm?
Played by Anya Taylor-Joy. She's
because there's that...
split second.
There's a scene
where
you kind of see her, yeah.
We
see
her face.
Yeah.
And she says like a few words and then she disappears. And
So I think Jessica is already like that terrifying, like... Macbeth's wife type figure already. Yes. I just love how she's so evil. Like, and she's got the thing stuff on her face. She's just so cool.
It was so, I thought particularly the parts where she's walking around with this the thing and then you can't see her face.
It was more disturbing.
Yeah, I think that's more disturbing because it's this kind of this inhumanness to her. Yeah.
I think it's a film that does not that is not afraid to make people look evil in a slightly over the top way, you know, like all the Harkonnen stuff with all the black slime and stuff, and it's like just do it.
It works so well.
Yeah, it does. So I mean, it's kind of so sincere that you can't make fun of it.
So what about the Harkonnen worlds?
Okay, so Gerdy Prime was shot on infrared lenses.
Okay,
which is why it looks so weird.
And then like reversed or something like what like. How does it?
So infrared lenses
what is it
have
supposed
no.
To be?
So they have no infrared filter. They have no infrared filter.
Right. Okay.
So you can get a very stark, washed out look.
Okay. So what's it supposed to be? This planet.
Like, it's this feudal world controlled by the Harkonnens, and it's been under the control of the Harkonnens for like thousands of years.
Why
or
is it white? And why is the sun black?
It's because.
Because the sun has a different wavelength.
The sun has different wavelengths,
It's just a weird... It's a weird place, right? They just... You've got an entire galaxy. There's some places are just weird.
There's some weird places.
So it's a very bright place, right? And they're on incredibly pale skins.
Yeah.
The sun is very close.
And they have this kind of extremely strong kind of feudal system inbuilt where, like, it's not just that you're serving under somebody. You're, like... Your life doesn't. I mean, obviously, because they kill them all the time.
Yeah.
Their lives don't matter to the higher ups, and they kind of have this kind of gladiatorial games and stuff. It's a very kind of feudal.
And that's where we're introduced to Feod Hrotha for the first time.
Such a
great introduction.
Yeah.
So they say we need to assess him to see if we can control him. First meet him.
Mm-hmm. We see a little bit of the insights of how the Bene Gesserit think through how they're going to control stuff.
They're so evil.
But it's such a brilliant fight scene. And with the colour.
Yeah.
It's so...
Yeah.
Like, it's so bright.
It just makes him seem utterly ruthless and... Well, as they say, he's psychotic.
Yeah.
But we can control him.
Because he's completely exposed.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
And when the camera pans down over the like auditorium or Colosseum, the screen goes to full and it feels like you're falling.
Yeah. I got some definite moments of falling.
Because you're looking up and then you're looking down and it's going down. It's
there's a bit when the camera went over a sand dune and I was like, oh,
that's terrific. Yeah. It's like a roller coaster.
Just the scale of all of it. I mean, we were talking before you went and watched. We were talking about the spaceships, and the scale. There weren't that many spaceships in this one. Pretty much no shots in space, I don't think.
Yeah.
But the shots, even when you see the dots in the sky, you know, when they're talking about the great houses, and you see them in the sky, and you know kind of what's coming because you've seen what the ships are. You've seen the ones that there's a particular shot in the first one. I remember where. There's a ship coming in, which looks like a very kind of Star Wars-y. It's like a sphere or spherical one. And you think it's going to be like 10 foot wide or something. And it lands and it's like the side of a skyscraper.
It's huge.
And
there's tiny little people getting out.
The Bene Gesserit are on at the beginning.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they come out the bottom and you're expecting it to come out from the top. And it's like this tiny little door.
Yeah.
The scale of it is just impressive. The whole thing is jaw-dropping. It's event cinema.
Yeah.
The kind of thing you have to see on a big screen.
I do think, like, you couldn't choose a better film to go and see at the IMAX.
No, it's fantastic.
awesome.
Loved it. We need to wrap up soon. Cool. So I'm going to drive home.
So I think we're probably done. Basically, we really loved it, and we haven't had time to think about the things we didn't like about it. It was just great.
Yeah, it was great. Not enough Dave Bautista.
No, but he needs just some more films, just of him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair enough. Awesome. Thanks a lot, Harry. Thanks a lot, Ben.
That's all right.
See you next time.
Yeah.
Thanks, listener.
Bye.